The following is a special presentation of KKCR Radio. Live from the incredibly sophisticated studios at KKCR in Hanalei, it's the King Zor Show! Okay, let's actually make that King Zor's Pauhana happy hour. Aloha, everybody. You know, a lot of my shows, first let me do the business that I got to do at hand. You are listening to Kauai's Community Radio, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. And King Zor's Pauhana happy hour is made possible by listeners like you and KKCR's sustaining members in partnership with Hawaii Compassionate Care, Crater Lake Spirits, and Island Soap and Candle Works.
Kevin Bako, MD of Hawaii Compassionate Care, offers medical marijuana certification exams at his office in Kapa'a. Information and appointments available at 808-854-6335. Or online at HawaiiCompassionateCare.com.
Crater Lake Spirits is proud to support KKCR and the beautiful island of Kauai. You can find their full line of handcrafted vodkas, naturally flavored vodkas, gin and rye whiskey in select finer restaurants, lounges, and liquor stores. Crater Lake Spirits, from Oregon, with love.
Island Soap and Candle Works. Handcrafting Hawaiian soaps, candles, and body products on Kauai since 1984. Open daily from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. in the Princeville Shopping Center, Island Soap and Candle Works proudly underwrites this KKCR program. IslandSoap.com.
And mahalo for supporting Kauai's community radio. Well, shows for me start in interesting ways, and this show started in a way that many people have started a number of great jokes. This is not going to be a joke show, though, but a man walks into a bar. Now, if that ain't the beginning of a bunch of great jokes, I have no idea what is. But in my case, the man who walked into the bar was Ricky Farr. And I have been studying music for years and years and years and have read many, many names, but I had to admit that I did not know Ricky's name. I was rather embarrassed when I found out just exactly who Ricky Farr is. But the point of today's show is going to be to introduce you to this gentleman and, in his own words, find out what he is all about. Ricky, welcome to KKCR.
Well, thank you for, as you say, an inopportune moment coming in to see my old friend from many years ago, Tauranga, and walked into the bar. And there you were, and all of a sudden, lights went on, as they do, eyes of interest, not just your work and what you do and your radio show, but your knowledge of music and the past. And normally I tend to put a blanket over that because it can get, you know, after all these years, very complex, but it was very interesting, and I just felt I've just fallen in love with this island. It's the fourth time I've been here, and I just fell in love with the island, and I thought if I could share a few moments with some of the islanders, because, you know, I brought Bob Marley to the Big Island. I produced Bob for 18 years, did his sound and production, and we lost him in Miami in 81, and
sad loss.
Yeah, we were getting ready for another tour, and it was don't let's start on a sad note.
But, no, let's not.
But I have so many amazing memories. But I've fallen in love with your island, so I'm thrilled. And King, I'm really happy to be here. And anything that this old memory can dredge up that's of interest to your listeners, let's do it.
Well, I know that my listeners love to know about the history of rock and roll. I have been a student of rock and roll ever since I first saw my first band and had to know, why is the rhythm player playing in a super reverb, and why does the lead player have a twin reverb, and the bass player's playing through a Showman, and I was just so into the tech and understanding what they were doing. I'm just a geek that way. I just like to know. And so on a number of my shows in the past, I have featured the bass players. I featured the organ players. I got to the point where I even did a show about cowbells and the little round circle on a cymbal that makes that ding, ding, ding sound. So, and people have told me that they found it fascinating. So when I met you and you offered so graciously to join us here in the studio, that I couldn't pass the opportunity up, and I'm very proud to have you sitting here. Now, folks, you probably, we're going to let you know who Ricky Farr is, but I'm going to start way back with your parents. Now, your father was the heavyweight champion of England and the Commonwealth.
And Europe. Yeah.
And he was the boxer who went into Yankee Stadium in New York to give Joe Louis his first title match after Joe Louis had won. And your father was defeated by Joe Louis, but it was by a half a point after a half point decision after 15 rounds. Would you talk about Joe Louis and his influence on your life?
Well, I was born in 42 in the middle of a bombing raid, and I was a very heavy baby because in those days women used to drink Guinness and Mackeson because that's how they got their protein for their pregnancy, and of course the babies were very large. I was 13 pounds 9 ounces.
Wow.
And my mother was not that small, but you know, when I was born, I think they thought Hitler had dropped another bomb. So I came into the world, and after the war, this great gentleman, as big as my father, came and stayed at our house, and it was Joe Louis, and he became my godfather, and a big, gentle, powerful man, and it was so good because I saw my father, who was sort of Welsh, white, Northern Viking Welsh, and I saw the son of a sharecropper from Alabama, and I saw the two of them, the respect and the affection, because they were two great warriors and gladiators, and they were going to have the rematch in England after the war, but unfortunately it just didn't work out that way.
Mm-hmm.
But the friendship and respect that I saw, and that was such a tremendous footprint for me to grow up with and see that. And this is why, you know, to me, color, race, and creed, and of all the artists I've worked with from all colors and races and creeds, from Bob Marley to Otis Redding to Stevie Wonder to Lionel Richie to Ozzy Osbourne to Barbra Streisand, I mean, it's a real bandwidth of color, race, creed, and soul.
Uh-huh.
And that in my early stages gave me this wonderful initiation into the brotherhood of men. And,
beautiful.
And something I was forever grateful for. My father's gone now many years, but he's there influencing me every day. Because in that 15th round, if you see the fight, you can get it on YouTube. He went to Joe Louis in the 15th round, and Joe was sitting on the stool. They were both, as my father said, I didn't want to fight the 15th round. I wanted to go to bed. And my father looked at him and said, Joe, you got a bigger heart than me. Come out here and show me. And, in fact, my father won the 15th round. And that's when the crowd were going crazy. And you can watch it on YouTube. It's pretty, those were days of 3-ounce gloves. That's when, when you took a blow, you knew it.
It was pummeling.
It was. And you had to be a boxer, because if you just slugged it out, you didn't last very long.
No, indeed. And your mother was an actress and a equestrian and a race car driver. You come from
pilot
as well. She won the first race ever at Brands Hatch in Delahaye.
Sorry, not Brands Hatch. It was Brooklands.
Oh, Brooklands. Okay.
Brooklands, right.
And, wow, an amazing set of parents, and here you are now. I understand that in England at the time, if you were the son of the heavyweight champion, you pretty much had a lot of defending yourself to do.
Well, you know, King, you go into a pub and you're the son of the heavyweight champion on a Friday night, and there's a few with a skin full of beer. they want to put a notch on their belt. So my brother and I, Gary, who is no longer with us, but we'd be in a pub. We always made sure we sat near the rear door or a window. And it got one time where some, anyway, it won't go into too many details, but it got very offensive and very cruel. And my brother and I said, enough of this. And we got stuck into it. And in front of the judge the next morning, he said to me, have a choice. You can go into the army or go back to your father. And I thought, no, hell with the army. I've done my student cadet bit. I'm going to go back to my father. And I was expecting to get all sorts of walloping, but he put his arm around me and said, look, you defended your family name, and you defended my name, and I will never hold you to task for that. But I do know that you've shown some temper, and you could have done some damage. And so I'm going to get you a passport and some money, which he did. He got me £100, which was a lot of money in those days.
Quite a lot of money,
yeah,
yes.
I took off to Sweden because that's where the pretty girls were.
Good for you.
And after spending some good time there, I got kicked out of there and went down to Denmark, where I had some wonderful time. I actually got a job at the old Blue Note, where Stan Getz was playing.
Oh, fantastic, yeah.
And working behind the bar, and some guy asked me, oh, you know, where are you from? And I said, oh, I'm from UK. And he's, you got a work permit? I said, no, I'm just helping out. And the next thing, I didn't realize he was on off-duty customs, whatever. So they put me on the late-night ferry to Hamburg, from Grosse Brügge to Hamburg. And I got in late night or midnight, whatever it was, and it was raining, and I had a little money in my hand, and I thought, okay, I went down to the red light district because everybody had heard about it.
The Reeperbahn.
Reeperbahn, Winkelstrasse. So I'm standing on a street corner, and I thought, okay, they have these little carts that sell these chili dogs, and I thought, I'll have one of those and find the Siemens Mission or the YMCA and get a night's sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm standing there, and all of a sudden I hear, oh, I know who you are. You're the boxer's boy. I read about you in the newspapers. You were in trouble for fighting. And I turned around and I said, oh, for God's sake, here we go again. He says, no. He says, I'm John Lennon. I'm with the Beatles over at the Kaiser Keller. And I said, where's that? He said, over there. And I saw this little black door that led down. And he said, oh, come over. And I really didn't know what I was going to do in my life. And I walked down those steps. And there were the drunken sailors and the prostitutes and the cheap perfume and the smell of beer and the bagels and this music, you know, Roll Over Beethoven and all that, you know, that sort of early where the Beatles got their influences, that mm-hmm, Everly Brothers yeah. music. And I knew right then that I fell in love. I just fell in love with that whole sense of freedom and color, because you have to remember, born in the war, coming out of the war, everything was gray and green,
right.
and
yeah.
there was no color.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the 60s was such a renaissance of color and brightness. And I fell in love. I just knew what I wanted to do and hung around for a few days. And then, you know, George got deported because he was underage, and they had actually agreed to go to play the Star Club. And I think it was Bruno, the man owner, heard about it, and the Beatles got sent home. But I went down to Portugal and Spain and hitchhiked a boat over to Liverpool from Lisbon and hooked up with the lads. And come on, Rick, you know, you're a good talker. You know, come and put some shows on, for God's sake. So I stuck all these yellow and black posters everywhere in little town halls saying, soon to be recording stars, the Beatles.
And how prophetic that was, indeed.
And,
that's
yeah,
great.
And Ringo was in the band because he had a drum, as they call a drum kit. And he left Rory Storm and the Hurricanes and joined up with them. And it was an amazing time. And all these bands were starting. The Animals were starting. And the early Moody Blues. And you know, Steve Winwood, who was underage. And he uh-huh. had to come in through the back door to sing Keep on Running because, you know, it was that amazing. Nobody knew what, there was no university for this.
Well, it had never been done before.
No.
It was just being created in the moment at that time. And it's, I suppose it's the confluence of all of those events that you're talking about, the war, the fact that there's maybe a little bit of money now and people are just tired of gray and drab. And here comes this happy music that
yeah.
the kids are looking for that. So you wound up creating venues or generating, you went to the town halls around and you scored the space and put the bands in. And
that's right. Exactly right. And I remember places like Croydon and Hazelmere Town Hall and the pier at Brighton and, you know, Portsmouth Civic Center. I mean, we'd put on shows wherever we could go. And, you know, the owners would say great because they needed the bar business. And we'd do it for 5 shillings, 7 shillings and sixpence and put on a show and realized we needed better audio and we needed a little bit of lighting and then we need to play records in between. And there was no such things as DJs in those days.
Right.
And except on the BBC. And all of a sudden, kids were coming up. We just put up posters and we were getting lines outside the door for bands they'd never heard about.
Wow.
But it just, and you heard the bands, like there was Bluesology, which had Elton John on piano.
Oh, wow.
And you could hear them honing those songs, which are now classics.
Right, exactly.
And in the early days, and, you know, Free, and, you know, with Paul Rodgers, and you could just hear those bands developing their music, which was later on, once it had been polished, recorded, and those are songs that you can turn on and you can stream today at greater amounts than ever were when they were on vinyl.
Oh, yeah, exactly. They're so available now.
Yes.
But at the time, I mean, I recall I was young relative. I'm 10 years younger than you are.
Okay.
So in my experience, that extra 10 years, things are already happening. There are places to go, and where I was from, we didn't have dance halls. We had high school dances, and I remember that the band that I was playing in 1968 was beaten out for a slot at my high school's, it was the junior prom, and the band that beat us out was the Allman Joys, and it was Greg and Dwayne Allman. And
oh, right.
I was so glad that that we were not able to be up there playing, because I get to be on the floor watching these guys. And there again, that's perhaps the second generation of young artists who are picking up the blues and shifting it forward. But there you were, right in the middle of it. Now, one of the things that I read about when I was reading about your life was that you would go to, what was the Naffies?
Oh, yes, yes.
They had a bunch of dance halls that were built during World War II for, mm-hmm. for the soldiers. And there were American soldiers, and there were Navy, and there was
Canadian,
Army.
Canadian, yeah, absolutely.
Yes, all these soldiers, and they needed entertainment.
Uh-huh.
So they built a bunch of
Naffy ballrooms.
Naffy
yes.
ballrooms.
And, of course, after the war, they were all empty,
mm-hmm.
and they were decaying. Not decaying, but they were definitely, you know, pigeons were living
in disrepair, yeah.
So I struck a deal where I could get, I could lease some of them, and we'd go in and clean them up. And the one thing that was really great was these wonderful, huge oak floors.
Yeah,
from the days of the big band, people would do those Lindy Hops and, mm-hmm. and dances. And so we would strip the floors, because this new generation, we were listening to Stax and, you know, Junior Walker and the All-Stars, and we were listening to Sam and Dave, and we were listening to James Brown. And the kids were copying those James Brown dances. So having those polished floors, and then they had bars, of course, so we used to make those into speakeasy bars. And
uh-huh.
and we'd just do pop art and blue light, and we'd hang speakers from the ceiling and play these imported records. I mean, Richard Branson was bringing them in, Chris Blackwell from Island Records,
uh-huh.
who I partnered with when I worked with Bob Marley for 13 years. And
mm-hmm.
and Chris was bringing in all the records, and I would get copies of them first, and, you know, Otis Redding and all this great music. And the British bands were listening to it, and the northern bands were more pop, and the southern bands were more blues-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have the Yardbirds with Eric Clapton and, excuse me, and Manfred Mann and Steve Winwood, Spencer Davis. You'd have the southern bands who were playing a lot, and also some of the Midland bands like the Animals, who mm-hmm. had the great hit Rising Sun, which was an old New Orleans blues
uh-huh.
song. And banned on the radio, by the way.
Because, oh, was it?
No, it was banned because if you listen to the lyrics of the song, it was about a young man who was brought up in a brothel.
Right.
And, you know, and because it, it was anti-religion, and it got banned by a lot of people. But, hey,
But the sensitivity that they brought to the recording, though, was I've always loved the Animals for their they were a very raw and essential sound. It was just beautiful. I loved it.
Well, you know, Pricey on piano and you know, Chas Chandler became a dear friend of mine, and in fact, it was Chas who introduced me when he brought Jimi Hendrix over.
Uh-huh.
And Jimmy was unheard of, and they were rehearsing at the Bag of Nails in London, and I was at the Marquee Club across the way, and he said, you've got to come over and hear this. And it was pouring rain. I said, no, Jazz. And he was on the phone. He said, no, you've got to come over. And I knew Noel Redding from previous bands, and I also knew Mitch. And I remember opening the door, and it was midday, and this wall of sound hit me, and I saw these rows of Marshall stacks. And that's the first time I met Jimmy, and nobody would touch him. Because here was this guy, almost like a freak at that time, with this mass of hair and, you know, skin-tight chamois leather trousers with an emerald, you know, plastic emerald in his navel, and this sort of Moroccan waistcoat in the middle of the raining London. And he was putting he was playing a Flying V at the time, and I was just sitting there, and I just said, this is in another world. And Chaz, because by now I was, shall we say, a producer, promoter of some repute or renown.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he was from up the way there, from, I think, Newcastle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the way to the talk up there, he said, hey, Rick, you got to give me some dates. Got to get me some dates for Jimmy, and what can you do? Away, come on. And I said, all right, Chaz, let's see what we can do. And actually, I was having dinner, a late-night dinner with Robert Stigwood, who had the concession for the Savile Theater. And I was telling Robert about, because Stigwood was managing the Bee Gees, had RSO Records. He was just doing so many interesting things. And I said, you know, you got to do something. And I said, putting him in clubs may not be the right thing. And although we put him in the Marquee Club, Jimmy in the Marquee Club, it was too loud. So he said, what about the Savile? So the Savile Theater. And we said, okay, perfect. So the Savile Theater, and I remember that night, everybody, Princess Margaret was everybody.
Wow.
Everybody,
yeah.
Anthony Snowden, everybody, all that Twiggy, all that hip London crowd at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And they were hip. I mean, they weren't phonies. They were really doing things, changing fashion and, you know, hairstyles and clothing. And the place was just to the rafters. And he went out there. And the funny thing was, he had some Ronson lighter fluid, and he put the guitar on the ground, and he's finishing, and he's got his feedback going. And I remember, you know, this is a very old London theater, and the old guy is like Benny Hill, you know, he's the stage manager with the glasses, and he all of a sudden sees the stage and some fire, and he's trying to get the asbestos curtain to come down, and I'm holding it and saying no, and I'm pulling it back up again, and it's up and down. And Chaz was there, and Chaz was a big guy, 6'2", and he said, "No, Rick, let the show finish, you know." This guy, no, there's a fire. I said, no, it's, and you know, that was, and unfortunately, many years later in '70, Jimmy played for me at the Isle of Wight Festival, and that was his last concert. 3 days later, he'd passed on.
Yeah.
So, I was thrilled to be in there at the beginning, and I was saddened but joyful that he was able to play to 600,000 people on the Isle of Wight, actually 620,000 people for his last show. And now a beautiful, gentle, amazing man who the guitar and the human body became one, not unlike Jeff Beck.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk of guitar players, when the body and Prince,
mm-hmm.
Okay. Right? Where the body and the guitar become rooted together, and it's and something comes out that isn't just the fingers. It's from the soul, the feet, the body, every sinew of thought and emotion and dynamic just comes out, and that's when you hear the great, great guitar players.
Oh, amazing. Yeah.
And it's been my privilege to see them up close and be close to them, and you know.
Oh, what a wonder. Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
So you wound up almost creating out of whole cloth a hip scene for kids to be at, and started with the Ari, the Naffy
ballrooms, yeah.
Naffy ballrooms, and then moved on to...
The Marquee Club.
And you were at the Naffy Ball Club. If I'm not incorrect, you were not so much having live bands for those events as having just record playing. You were playing records, and the kids would come in and listen and dance. And
well, you know, my good friend Ronan O'Reilly, he'd started a pirate radio ship called Radio Caroline that was 3 miles off,
mm-hmm.
and it was an old trawler. And I used to go out there and... And Ronan was great fun. It was, we won't go into the fun we had. It was too much fun. How did nobody fell overboard? I don't know. But at any rate, he had Radio Caroline, which really was a sort of, it was a wean off of Radio Luxembourg. And on that, he was broadcasting, and a great friend of mine, John Peel, who had a show called The Perfume Garden. John passed on some years ago, but he... they were playing really interesting new music. And whether the music would be from India, whether it be the initiation of sitar music,
mm-hmm.
to Arabic modals, to the stuff the Stones were doing, to the Pink Fairies, to early Pink Floyd, to, you know, all of the things that were happening there, the very Danny Cohen and Pete Green in the early Fleetwood Mac,
right.
you know, playing Robert Johnson blues. And, you know, at the same time, the Beatles were coming out of this pop and they were realizing they had some deeper, more serious things to. And they went, you know, they went on to the White Album, Revolver, Sgt. Pepper's. And out of America was coming amazing music. I mean, Pet Sounds, by the Beach Boys.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And some of the early Love.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, My Heart, My Girl, She Comes in Colors. And some of the things that we'd done in England were happening. Bill Graham was doing, and John McGay was doing in America, and then putting on like the Fillmores, and lighting designers were doing liquid lights. And,
yes, the beautiful.
You know, people got a little bit into the lysergic acid, and it opened up a lot of minds.
A little bit, yeah.
A little bit here and there. This is a rated show, is it?
Well, it is a freeform radio show, and discussing the fact that people took acid in the day is not beyond the pale. It's simple truth, and it did open up. There was legal for quite a while.
Absolutely.
And people were discovering that there was a new way out there.
Well, Dr. Timothy Leary preached the mind expansionism, and a lot of people listened to him. Those that handled it and dealt with it and realized this new freedom of unleashing your mind from the constrictions of what you're supposed to do and how to do. I mean, you know, one of the artists, I can talk with you of so many artists, but one of the artists that I truly, truly loved as a man and as a person was Bob Marley.
Mm-hmm.
Because to see Bob Marley take and influence a crowd and influence an audience, and the way he was truly a poet, he was also a preacher, who managed with the great, you know, the great Wailers, Peter Tosh, mm-hmm. and Barrett, and Ashton, you know, was able to put this sense of island rhythm together. But then his words and his preaching and the dynamics and the way that he presented his words, and he took them from stories. You know, I Shot the Sheriff was based on a true story. Buffalo Soldier, mm-hmm. you know, the 42nd Cavalry.
Right.
You know, the whole, I had, that's when I realized that those artists that were able to deliver their lyrics and their songs and their music to people. You know, Bob Dylan, you know, I worked with Bob for 9 years. I was very fortunate to uh-huh. convince him to come out of retirement to play the 1969 Isle of Wight Festival, because he'd had the motorcycle accident up in Bethel in Woodstock. And he came over, and I convinced him, come and play the Island of Poets, the Isle of Wight.
Yes, definitely.
And I gave him the poetry of Longfellow and all. I said, in the Garden Isle, and he said, oh... You know the way he talks. He said, "Oh,
yeah, sounds like a good
island of poets." Yeah, okay,
I could do that.
Yeah, and he said to Al Aranowitz, who I was with, and And he said, Al, what do you think? We go to an island of poets. And Ricky, I think we'll do it. Let's do it. Talk to Albert Grossman, my manager, and there we go.
And that kind of brings us to the Isle of Wight. I should just take a quick moment and let people know that you're listening to Kauai's Community Radio, KKCR. I'm King Zor. This is the Pauhana Happy Hour. And today I'm dedicating the show to Ricky Farr, whose story is one of the lesser-known stories, but truly one of the most important. I mean, let's put it this way. You can't have a band on a stage unless there's a stage to have a band on.
Amen. Amen.
And from the work that you did with the Naffy Ballrooms and managing the different clubs, you were creating that opportunity for bands to play and for young people to experience and just get it on in their own way, whatever way that is. It was a freedom of the 60s that allowed that.
Mm-hmm.
But there had to be people who were doing the hard slog in the background, and you're one of those guys. And it's, like I say, such a pleasure to have you on the show. Now,
my pleasure.
In 1968, you were approached by some people on the Isle of Wight who were doing, it was a school for physically challenged, I guess perhaps mentally challenged, I wasn't sure.
Physically challenged children.
Yeah, physically challenged children, and they needed a swimming pool.
Correct.
And they needed some recreational facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so they approached you to create an event that would earn money for them, and they could, it was a benefit concert.
Correct.
That was in 1968. Tell me about that first one.
Well, across the channel on the mainland in Portsmouth and Southsea, one of those Naffy Ballrooms was a place that I had named after the great book, Brave New World.
Uh-huh.
And it was a place that people came to from all over, because in one night, actually, I was looking at some of the old posters. In one night, we had the Yardbirds, Little Stevie Wonder, who had a hit with a record
Fingertips. Yes.
Right? So we had
Parts 1 and 2.
That's right. We
on
had
the
Yardbirds, Little Stevie Wonder, and I Can Tina Turner.
Oh, wow.
On one night for 7 shillings and 6
pence.
Which wasn't even $4.
Wow.
And it was a place where people came and heard and saw music from all over. And The Folk Brothers, who had a printing company over there and were trying to put together this event, came over and said, what can we do? Well, Neil Warnock, who was running NEMS for Brian Epstein, mm-hmm. which was the agency, Northern Entertainment Music, which was the Beatles agency, mm-hmm. which had a lot of artists on it, were bringing in some artists, and they were bringing in Jefferson Airplane.
Oh, wonderful.
And I said, well, would they like to come onto the Isle of Wight? And I said, I don't know what the situation is. I've got to go and check it out. And then The Crazy World of Arthur Brown, who had a big hit record with Fire. And then was the group, the new group, The Move, that had I Can Hear the Grass Grow. And
mm-hmm.
there were a lot of really cool bands. So it was Young Donovan. And so I put the bands together, and the stage literally was 4 flatbed trucks. And Charlie Watkins came down and put on the WEM PA system, and it was a cornfield, and it was stubble, and it was uncomfortable to sit in. But there was a few thousand people came, and they paid, and the bands played. And Jefferson Airplane came in with some really good stuff from America. So we were all feeling really good.
Uh-huh.
And it was a great evening, and what I can remember of it. and yes, there was some money made for towards the swimming pool and the swimming pool association, and I went home, and literally a month later, the Folk Brothers called me and said, "We'd like to do this again, but we'd like to do it as an event." And I loved their naivety. They were very, very smart,
uh-huh.
but they were naive. And they said, "What about Bob Dylan?" I said, "Well, he's got a broken back, and he's from a motorcycle accident, you'll never get him." They said, well, why can't we try? And I thought, okay, that's a good...
Why can't we?
So we went, Ray Fulk and myself went to New York, and we waited in this hotel, the Mayfair Hotel, and we were ready to pack up and go home, and all of a sudden there was a knock on the door, and nobody had seen him because he'd basically been in hibernation. And
pretty much of a hermit for that 3 years of rehabilitation.
And when I opened the door, I looked like this guy who had just come off a golf course. He had the golf cap and he looked, this is not the Bob Dylan I was expecting, you know. And he came in with his friend, Al Aranowitz, and we sat down and we talked. And we talked about the island. And we talked about what he wanted to do. And he said, if I come over there and the Beatles agree, well, he said, I want my backing band to be the band who just had a big hit with the Big Pink.
Uh-huh. Music for Big Pink. Beautiful album.
Right. And I said, that would be wonderful. And they can do their own part of the show. And then you can come on and do your part. And he said, well, you know, he said, I've spoken to George. And George said, you know, the boys will get up and play. And I thought, wow, this is just...
Wouldn't that be nice?
And, you know, and I won't go into the depth of the story, but I went up to Apple, which is in Savile Row, and we all sat around the table, and all the guys and everybody and Big Mel Evans and all the team and Tony, and we all agreed to do it. And then all of a sudden, the voice piped up and said, John Stravinsky didn't have to play live to prove his music was valid. You could, if you play live, screw it up. And John went, oh, she's right, you know. Maybe we shouldn't do it. I will not tell you.
Just the feeling I get from your expression is fingernails on a chalkboard.
Yes, and I just...
Oh, no!
I had the plastic lotus flower stuck on the forehead, and I just thought, one of the great moments in music has just been washed away. But at any rate, he played with the band, and...
Now, I understand, too, that when he got there, he wanted to go to Carnaby Street?
Yeah.
This part of the story really fascinated me. It shows something about Bob Dylan's mentality at the time.
Well, Carnaby Street was... This is where it was feather boas and bell-bottom trousers and paisley-printed shirts, and it was that whole era.
Even in San Francisco, we heard about Carnaby Street and the whole fashion move.
And Bob Dylan wanting to go to Carnaby Street was... It just was so obtuse, and it didn't add up.
Uh-huh.
So George picked him up at London Airport and, you know, had his big rolls, and he went down to Carnaby Street, and when he got there... And I said, well, there's a really good store called Lord John. And, yeah, I want to go to Lord John. Well, he went into Lord John, and he bought this white suit that didn't fit him very well. In fact, it had to be pinned up.
Uh-huh.
And this sort of bright green, yellow, high collar, you know, those long high collar shirt. And these mustard yellow boots. And I thought, what on earth is going on here? This is not, I was expecting, you know, the jean and the leather waistcoat and the polo shirt and, you know, and that was my image of him.
Uh-huh.
And then when I went in, we had a trailer behind, I went in and said, I'd introduce the band and the band were playing. And it was ready for Bob to come up, so I went and said, are you ready, Bob? I'm going to go and introduce you. And he said, yeah, I'm ready. And I walked in the dressing room. And his wife, Sarah, was just pinning him up. And I'm looking at him and I'm thinking, this is like almost a showband, Irish showband.
Uh-huh.
And we had these giant Kleagle, what we call aircraft landing lights, mm-hmm. way back at the field.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked out and I said, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back, bringing his music to this island, a poet, a musician, an original, Bob Dylan. And boom, the lights came on. Now, the lights were on the stage, but these lights came on, blinding lights. And he walked out in this white suit, and I totally got it. It was almost like he was levitated.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to offend anybody of any religion, but it was religious. He looked like he was elevated off the stage.
Wow.
And there, you know, there was 100,000 people there. At the very back of the arena, they saw this white, messiah figure, and all he said, great to be here, Manfred Mann, great band. And he played one of Manfred's songs that he'd written, Quinn the Eskimo,
yeah.
And I just got this guy is so tuned in to the moment, to his reappearance, to his arrival.
Yeah, if you're going to come back out, come back out really big.
Come back out, yeah.
Be seen.
Because the band were there all in their Canadian lumberjacks, uh-huh. you know, check shirts. And he would have just you wouldn't have seen Bob Dylan. It was just blended. This way, it was just this white glow. And the trouble was that he only played for a little under an hour.
Uh-huh.
And his friend Al Aronowitz was on the right side of the stage. And I was there, and I thought at least another 15, 20 minutes. And the band, they had the songs in the play sheet. And for some reason, Al shouted, "Okay, Bob, that's it." And I'm looking at him going, no, please, no. And Bob turned and took his guitar off and waved to the crowd and said, "Great to be here, see you," and left. I said, "Aaron, what are you doing?" And he left. And the crowd, you see, you got to have to remember, just seeing Bob Dylan, this mythical figure, the first four or five songs, they flew by because they were just getting into seeing Bob Dylan again.
Right.
Or even for the first time.
And he had, over 3 years, he had released albums that had been seminal and very changing. Every album he did was a seminal and very changing album. But he had done, kind of flying in the face of the time, he had done Nashville Skyline.
That's right.
And he was going through these other changes. And so people who had never perhaps seen him before, but for the rest of the guys who had never seen him, they're thinking back to the freewheeling Bob Dylan. They want to...
Yes.
They're thinking all these songs that they've never seen, the whole Blonde on Blonde album.
Highway Revisited, yeah.
Yeah, Highway 61 Revisited.
Revisited, yeah.
Beautiful stuff, and I'm sure that they wanted to hear like him to sit there and play all of those albums start to finish. And
well, in an hour he encapsulated and he was gone. And another 15 minutes, even then, if he played 2 hours, they were. But it was his first time back.
I can understand from his perspective.
Yeah, and Al was sort of his meter.
Uh-huh.
And I think if he'd left him for three or four more songs. But I had to go out, and the crowd was shouting,
more.
And the funny thing was, there was John and Yoko sitting in the front. There was Paul and Ringo. And George, because we had Ravi Shankar on earlier, and there was Jane Fonda with Roger Vadim, and there were everybody sitting there,
uh-huh.
And they were like, "We came down, he's gone," you know, and I'm like, I couldn't care too much about that, but the people behind them, the crowd, I just wanted them to have more.
Yeah,
and I didn't know what we could do to follow after that, and there's a British folk artist called Ralph McTell, and who had. So I just said, Ralph McTell was supposed to come on. But I said, "Well, hold on." And I'd gone back, and Richie Havens was there.
Oh, great.
And I said, "Richie, would you come in?" I said, "We need some." And I walked out and I said to the people, "You call back for four encores from Richie Havens." Richie came back to see Bob. Bob was left, but Richie would love to give you more music. Would you like that? And the crowd, just as one, said, "Yeah!" And Richie came out with the conga drums and just a guitar, and he started that, that Richie Havens, on the conga drums. And then the whole crowd's going, "Oh, yeah." And he held them almost like a chant.
Wonderful.
For about 4 or 5 minutes. And the whole crowd going, "Oh, yeah." And then he'd go, "Ooh." And then he'd start singing a Beatles song. And he would just, Richie Havens just, and he played for over an hour.
Oh, fantastic.
And he just wore them out.
Oh, great.
And they just felt at that moment, they'd seen Bob Dylan, they'd had more of Richie Havens, and they all went back to the tent city where they were camping and all went to sleep happy.
Oh, that's beautiful. What a wonderful story, and what a great fact that you were able to convince Bob to come out of retirement. Don't just while away your time. You're a performer. Perform. That's what a gift of gab that John had recognized way back early. You must have had a great gift of gab to...
Come on, put on some shows, or come on, do some shows. Come on.
Well, that's great, and then you get Bob Dylan to come out of retirement. And 150,000 people, Isle of Wight, too. And as I heard, as the stories I've read, the history that I studied about this, it was very popular on the Isle of Wight. The people were, like, the first one was a single-day event, and the second one was multiple days.
4 days.
It was a four-day event for the second one. So the people of the communities were economically enriched.
Totally, yes.
And the farmers and the awareness of the Isle of Wight in general was greatly enhanced.
Yes.
So were they the ones who, the people who were there, who wanted you to come back and do a third 1970 version?
Yeah, you know something? You've really read up. I'm very flattered, and I must say very appreciative that you've got it right, King. You've obviously looked at the facts. Well, what happened was is that on the Bob Dylan Festival, the people were so gentle and so peaceful, and, you know, the island didn't take advantage of them, but they provided them with the water and the food and, and sleeping and bed and breakfast or whatever and all sorts of things. And it brought a tremendous amount of income to the island with absolutely no... I think for the whole four-day event, there was a total of 5 arrests.
Wow.
Yes.
No, that's really amazing.
Well, they had more arrests when they would have Cowes Weekend, which was a yachting regatta. So... everybody's very impressed, and they said, come back. Now, one of the problems was then that we wanted to do something very special. And I'd spoken to Dick Katz, and he said Jimmy could be available. I know that Jim Morrison, and I'd met Jim in Paris, he couldn't go back to America because of...
Because of the incident.
The incident, which was BS. You've probably seen the documentary.
I have.
Right, and... So he wanted to stay in Paris, and he said, okay, we'll have the Doors. We'll have the Doors. The Who wanted to play. Chris Blackwell from Island Records had ELP, so he said, let's introduce Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
Excellent.
So I said, great, and the Moody Blues, and Miles Davis wanted to play with Chick Corea and Chicago, and Sly and the Family Stone, and Joni Mitchell, and... everybody, including Tiny Tim, who actually was a huge success going out with the megaphone singing, there'll always be an England. And the crowd, I've seen it all now.
Wow.
Seen it all now. Because before that, I had Rory Gallagher and Taste out there really playing Irish blues. And anyway, so it was an amazing event with a huge, you know, Jethro Tull, just on and on and on with great, great music. And what had happened was Parliament, you know, had realized that young people were putting on events and there was these vast gatherings. And there was the Conservative Party in who didn't like it. You know, we're a bunch of long-haired communists who were... You know,
it's not the British way, is it?
That's right, exactly right. You know, these damn guys with their long hair and their beads and all their nonsense and plucking these banjos and doing their drugs and, you know, absolutely ruining the youth of our country. They should all be in the bloody army with haircuts. So,
they were like that in America, too.
Right, so I thought I'd go up against that, and I did, and... They were trying to introduce a thing called the Night Assemblies Bill, which didn't allow for more than one night a gathering of people of over 30,000 people. But I discovered there was over 60,000 Boy Scouts up in Bangor, Wales, having kumbaya for three nights. So my argument was, how can the Boy Scouts do it? And why can't we do it? Just because of the music's different?
Right,
and
right.
There was a gentleman his name was Sir Mark Woodnut, MP, Member of Parliament. And I got to meet him, and I just met him in the pub, and we chatted. And he said, you know, your father's a great man, and I really got to believe that he brought you up well. And I said, well, partially, but I will tell you that I want to know why you want to ban all these people, peaceful people, who want to listen to their music and sit in the field and enjoy themselves. He said, I couldn't agree more. And he went in and he made a speech in Parliament. and he turned everybody around, and the Knight Assembly's bill got squashed.
Wow.
And we were able to do it. But unfortunately, power is power. So then they got in touch with the guys on the Isle of Wight, the MPs for the Isle of Wight, and said, okay, let them put on their event, but make sure they put it on somewhere where they can't win.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
They stuck us, they said, we'll only approve this, and they gave us Ashton Downs. So it meant that it was an amphitheater of freedom to anybody that didn't want to go. Paid to go to the festival.
Yeah, because we're talking about a narrow strip of land that could be fenced, but then hillsides all the way around it.
You've got it.
And who's going to pay when you get the hillside? No, you're not as close, you're not as proximate, you're not going to see, but you'll be there, it'll be part of the event, and ultimately it's they were down on you.
Well, there was a group of people which cynically were called the French Maoists.
Mm-hmm.
And something even more cynical, the White Panthers, which was the white British version of the Black Panthers, which is just so horrible and so wrong.
It's so wrong.
And they were giving out leaflets, don't pay, the music will be free. And they were sending this thing. And the French Maoists came over in these luxury, from France, these luxury coaches with these printing machines. And they paid with their bus £20 to come over and £20 to go back in the bus. And the ticket for 4 days was £3 to see. Actually, the ticket was for 5 days, but 2 days were free. And imagine that all the water, the toilets, the food, the electricity, the artists, everything, the helicopters bringing people in from the mainland, that should all be free. It was just so preposterous. And it wore me out, frankly, King. There was a time when they were threatening the stage, and they'd all had these red headbands on, and I'd received a Coca-Cola can with a bullet in it, and it said, the next one's yours. Wow. And that's when Chris Christopherson, he's playing, and he looks over at me, he says, I think they're going to shoot us, Ricky. And I said, and he said, I'm out of here, and he left. The crowd started booing, and there was a priest who was collecting money for people who wanted to get home.
Uh-huh.
And who'd lost their money or just tripped out or whatever. And I said, look, any spare coins, send them to the front. They'll go to the church and go down to, I think it was the St. Mary's of Freshwater, and the priest will help you with tickets and get home.
And as I heard it, you asked them to also clean up the place by putting your spare change in a can.
Yes.
So you're cleaning the cans forward.
That's
what
right.
A brilliant idea. May I just say, I thought that was such a brilliant idea.
It got rid of litter, but it helped some people, and it helped a lot of people. But the priest was there, and some of these guys were in the front with the red hand, and they were trying to spit on him and throw stuff on the priest. I lost it. And it's now the famous rant. Well, it wasn't a famous rant. We'd had a great, you see the whole Isle of Wight movie.
Uh-huh.
Was being great connection between myself and the audience. But I just said to these guys, you bastards, you know, we spent a year putting this on this with a lot of love, and you come to destroy it, well, you can go to hell. I said it in a lot more forcible way.
I should have that. I should chew that up. But, go ahead and...
And, you know, at the end of it, I said, look, and the Folk Brothers were behind the stage, and I went down, and they said, Ricky, calm down, calm down. I said, okay. I said, but I'm not, those people can't destroy this for everybody else. It's 2% of the audience. And they said, look, why don't you just go up and just declare the festival free? And that's when I went up and said, for all of you who want to go out, go out. Now, all of you want to come in, come in. But just let's have some music. And that's when we played The Great Awakening, and everybody stood up, and I said, put your hands together. And the audience, was just a mile and a quarter to the very back, and everybody's hands was in the air. And, you know, in the film I was in tears, and I'm almost in tears now talking about it. It's just, it was an unforgettable moment in my life.
Let me go this and this, and then do this.
What do you?
I have Neil Rand.
Oh, you do?
We put this festival on, you bastards, with a lot of love. We worked for 1 year for you pigs. And you want to break our walls down? And you want to destroy it? Well, you go to hell!
1, 2, 3, 4.
And you know something? If you listen to that in the background, you can hear the crowd cheering. Because they were sick and tired of these guys. And, you know, they set fire to some of the food tents. And it just no... And all they would do was... And Roger wouldn't mind me telling you this story, but I was backstage, and all you would hear was, music should be free, or music should be free. And I'm like, shut up. And I was standing in the back with Roger, and Donovan had this beautiful gypsy caravan, and he had a fire, and we were just sitting there just chilling. And all of a sudden, in the back wall there, you saw this knife blade coming through, cutting through the canvas. And Roger's a good East End London boy. You didn't mess with it. Didn't mess with the Who, you know.
Right.
These were street kids.
Yeah. And particularly Roger. He was.
You can blank my language out. But at any rate, he saw, and all of a sudden his head comes through, and he goes, "Oh, Roger Daltrey, the Who, I love you. Music should be free." And all of a sudden, Roger picks up, I don't know, whatever it was, he fell on the floor, and he went, fuck off, and hit him straight in the head. He hit him right in the head, and this guy, boom, the head went back.
Why did you could be free, but ouch! Ouch!
I didn't even look to see where he was.
But out of this anger and out of this, honestly, frustrating, you worked for a year, and the second Isle of Wight was such a peaceful and beautiful thing, and out of that growth, these people are threatening it, but... You went out and actually started talking to the fans, to the people who were there, the audience.
Yes.
And it's in the movie. It's such a beautiful scene in the movie because you're just talking to the people out of your love for this event, out of the love for them and love for the music. You gathered that whole, and then we're talking not just a few people. We're talking 650,000 people, two times larger than Woodstock.
Absolutely right.
And you got them all to hold hands and to touch each other and sing Amazing Grace.
I'm not sure I'm correct on that. No, you're absolutely correct. And I'm a big old Welsh boxer, rugby player, and you're bringing me to tears because you brought me to tears.
and this is... 50 years later.
Well, I have to tell you that there's certain things in your life you get an opportunity to do.
Yes.
And there are certain times when, I will say this to you now, that I owe everything in my life to music. That's why I'm so active in it now. Music doesn't owe me a thing. But the people who love music, and from Bob Marley to Ozzy to Robert Plant to just artists who like slack guitar artists on the island playing, just to anybody that picks up an instrument and that finds a way in their life to be within themselves and to do something they create, whether they play badly or they play amazingly, that they play at all.
Yes. Yes.
That they play at all. There is no war in music. There is no cynicism in music. I would just wish our president would put on some headphones and listen to music for 3 hours before some of this Twitter goes out. I'm in no judgment of which party, but I will tell you, get more music into the White House, and I swear to God we'd have a better world. I had a major spine surgery, and I healed faster than anybody because I insisted in the Hogue that they brought music into my room. My children were born strong and healthy because I put music next to their mother's belly. I will tell you, just so funny, I'm staying up the hill here at Princeville. And, you know, it's going through some changes. And, you know, a lot of people were there and they're kind of, well, this is not what I'm paying for. And the truth is, I said, hold on, your food's an hour late, but it's a great meal. But you've had an extra hour to look at this beautiful island.
Yes.
And then I go down and I meet Eli and I meet Pono and I meet Scott and I meet Leland. And upstairs I meet Bryson. And I remember their names because they are such cool people.
Yeah.
And they all said, oh, you Ricky Farr, you Bob Marley guy, right? And I go, okay, yeah, yeah. And they said, man, we listen to that music. And I said, well, you know, I would be talking to Bob all the time. And he was saying, Ricky, man, I'd like to feel plenty of bass in my legs. Please make Phil put all the bass in the stage so I can be feeling the music. And, you know, Ashton, you can be putting the rhythm. And I would say, yes, Bob, you've got it. And I remember a story about Molly and that she wanted to talk about people.
Can we just break one quick moment? Because it's the top of the hour.
Oh.
And for the FCC regulations, I am required to say that you are listening to Kauai's Community Radio, KKCR Hanalea, KAQA Kilauea. I just needed to say that.
Well,
then we're in compliance.
No, thank God we're in compliance. Yeah, you know, but I was talking about the guys like Pono and Scott and all these guys who are working there, and they love music, and you can feel them doing such a great job. So going back to Bob, when Rhodesia went to Zaire, Bob was invited to be the artist for the handover of the Rhodesian government to the Zimbabwe. What is it? And we got, I don't know how we got the equipment and the generators there at any rate. So we get there. And I think it was Mobutu. They said, well, you know, he's only going to be playing for the dignitaries. And Bob said, no, man, I'm playing for the people. I'm here to play to the people. Let me play to the people. They said, no, you will play to the dignitaries. And Bob said, no, Ricky. And I remember he said to Nick Taylor, he said, Nick, take me out of here. And this guy looked at him and said, you are playing or you're not leaving. And I just saw it was fear. And I thought, oh, my God. And I said, let's play. So anyway, that night there was 150 people all dressed in these wonderful dignitary robes and what have you. But I went to this guy and I said, let me do me a favor. Let me take a bullhorn and go to the walls on the outside, because it's a soccer stadium. Let's go and tell the people, thousands and thousands of people outside, that we can put on a free concert tomorrow. We'll stay an extra day, and we'll put on a free concert. And tomorrow at 12 o'clock, open all the doors, and Bob will play. He played for 2.25 hours, and the people...
Beautiful.
And if you want to talk about one nation... All together.
Unifying, yeah.
Unifying. And when he came off, he was in tears.
Oh, gorgeous.
He was in tears, and the band was in tears. And it was, when you see these events, and this is why you say, why is Bob Marley so special to me, is because he is a preacher. He is a poet. But he also has a rhythm that I've seen little girls, white girls at the Lyceum, when we did Live at the Lyceum, Chris Blackwell with the men of Richard Branson's recording truck. And Bob got up on the stage, and these little London white girls who did their TV jerky, you know, disco TV dancing. All of a sudden, after an hour and a half later, they're all leaving, all liquid. And because he taught, I call it the University of Dance.
Yes,
and
it really is.
He could do that.
Yeah. I'm going to take a quick moment right now and honor our underwriters. For a moment, I just want to let people know that you're listening to Kauai's Community Radio, and the Pauhana Happy Hour is made possible by KKCR's sustaining members in partnership with the YWCA, Bill Fernandez, and Crater Lake Spirits.
YWCA Kauai is dedicated to eliminating racism, empowering women, and promoting peace, justice, freedom, and dignity for all. Full and part-time positions are now available to professionals seeking a fulfilling career in service to our community. Job listings and benefit package information available at ywcakauai.org or 245-5959.
Kauai author Bill Fernandez announces his new novel, Splintered Paddle. Western ships introduced King Kamehameha to the fury of the cannon during the Unification Wars in the late 1700s, and our young hero Kalani is chosen to oversee his armory. What he sees and learns in battle will shape the kingdom's future. More information about Splintered Paddle can be found at kauaibillfernandez.com.
Crater Lake Spirits is proud to support KKCR and the beautiful island of Kauai. You can find their full line of handcrafted vodkas, naturally flavored vodkas, gin and rye whiskey in select finer restaurants, lounges, and liquor stores. Crater Lake Spirits, from Oregon, with love.
And we're back. People are calling in. I just want to let you guys who are calling in know that I'm not going to be taking phone calls today. I'm in the studio with Bricky Farr, the gentleman who was the producer of three amazing Isle of Wight concerts, and who's your connection. You've been a producer, a promoter. You've been a talent agent. You've been... and the other thing, which I will be getting to in a moment, is your production company and your taking music into the stadium age.
Yes.
And that sort of stuff. So if you're calling, please, you know, hold on or call back later or, you know, sometime next week. Anyway, today is too special to interrupt.
Well, you know, listen, we should be blessed that people are listening and
interrupting. I'm so glad that
they are. But you know, we have the limited time we do.
Exactly.
Because I must tell you, everybody thinks that I've married a Hawaiian girl because my beautiful, beautiful wife, her name is Noni.
Indeed.
And she is part Cherokee, part Spanish American, and part English. And I met her in Arizona, and the great love of my life. But people think, what is this old dude doing with this beautiful Hawaiian girl? And we were in one of your restaurants in Hanalei. I love Hanalei. It's just we were in, I think, Postcards, and there was Amanda and Natalie, and just giving us the love, and it was just the great food. And I said to my wife, I said, you know, I'll never learn to spell the word retire. But I so envy you that you found a perch where you can talk to the people and have this radio show and be putting on the music with Todd together at that wonderful place, Tahiti.
Although we can't really say the names of it.
No, we don't. We won't mention names, beg your pardon.
Because we're community radio.
Understood. So forget all those names. They don't exist.
Well, those names don't matter because we're not attached to them.
No,
it's the other one we're attached to that I have to be careful with.
But by accident, meeting you there, and just I fall in love with this place. And if I am ever going to, I would love to. You know that I was said to my wife this morning, you know what would be great? If there was a piece of land where you could get 15, 25,000 people, I'd love to put on a Sunsplash music event once a year in Kauai that was by the people and for the people.
That'd be beautiful.
I would love to do that. And maybe if I get a spurt of energy, and because I do want to find a little plantation house somewhere, only have shorts and slip-ons in the cupboard, nothing else.
Yes.
And a good set of headphones, good speakers, and just be here and feel.
Well, I can tell that the island loves you. There is a beautiful, I've been here for 20 years now, and I've seen people come who just want to have a part of it and then go. And I've seen people who want to come and it's about them and go. But it sounds like the vibe I get from you so totally is that you want to bring to this. You don't want to take away from this. You want to bring to this and allow this place to be what it is.
Well, because, you know, it's called many things from a tourist point of view. But it's the one thing I don't see on the postcards. They talk of jungle this and movie this and Bali High that. And that's wonderful. But nobody says what it truly is. From all the islands, it has the greatest amount of soul. It has incredible soul.
Wow.
And all the islands have that soul. But here, it's deeper rooted, and the people have it. And I just feel that because being Welsh, we are a country that's never been... It's been attacked by the Romans and the Normans. It's the only country of the island, the British Islands, that's never been conquered.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, ferocious warrants. Yes, the Vikings did conquer the north part, but they conquered it as farmers. And that's, as you can tell from my coloring, I'm Viking Welsh.
And I'm just a shade that too.
Well, yeah, you got a little bit of the Irish.
It's true. Can't deny it.
And what we say in Wales, we say an Irishman is a Welshman who can't swim, can't get across the channel. But there is a soul here. And when I met you, the last radio show I did was for the BBC in England. And I must say, I was incredibly proud and impressed that it was 4.2 million people. Listeners came on. Because, you know, they have those memories, and they felt that I was part of that memory.
Uh-huh.
And I felt really honored that there was that listenership, to the point they offered me to come over and do a series of shows. One is enough. after a couple of hours, I can be a little boring.
I cannot see that.
No, but I, for all those people calling in and all the shout-outs, you know, love you for that. Never give up on the music. Let the music be in you. Let it be part of you. Let it be your cause. Let it be your dynamic. Let it be your lover. Let it be your thought. Let it be your process. And let it be the part, as John Lennon wrote so beautifully, imagine. Let music help you imagine. Because if you imagine and you feel, then you will feel who you are. And you are only you. Is that one single person on this planet. This is why the DNA for every one of us is different. You are special. You are you. And let music be part of that.
Beautiful. That's beautiful. Now, after the Isle of Wight 1970, which was difficult, and with having to open the doors up and to everyone, you were financially wrecked. And spiritually, I understand pretty much it's a lot of anger to process, and a lot of just the difficulties in general to process. But it was a Led Zeppelin concert that helped to pull you out, as I understand. Would you mind talking about that?
Where do you dig this up from, King? You are awesome, man. You dug this up. Well, let me just tell you, after the Isle of Wight, if you see the movie.
Uh-huh.
The movie ends with Murray Lerner sticking a microphone in my face and saying, what do you think? And it's just starting to rain. And it's just, I didn't know if it was just a field of rubble or it was a war zone. But the music had all left, and there was this eerie wind blowing and the rain coming down. And it was good because the rain was hitting me in the face, so he couldn't see that I was crying.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, there'll never be another event like this. Because to this date, that's the largest gathering of mankind without being under a military flag.
Uh-huh.
652,000 people. There's never been an event. I did another event, which was more people, but that was in Ireland when I was asked to present the Pope.
Uh-huh.
From a production point of view, with audio and everything. And that was a million people. But this was the largest event. And just to see that it had ended in that way, something triggered. I don't know what it is, but something had triggered. And I found this little cottage in Freshwater Bay, and I just holed up in it. And I don't know if I was feeling sorry for myself that I had been part of something that should have succeeded. We should have, don't know what we should have done, but big government, George Orwell, big government had pushed us on there, and the cynics had taken advantage of it, the Maoists and the Panthers, and we'd lost. But there'd been some amazing music. Murray Lerner had filmed it, but unfortunately turned it into somewhat of a cynical film. There were some beautiful moments that weren't captured, especially Sly and the Family Stone at the break of dawn.
Wow.
Those things, which were, to me, they were the metamorphosis between this bad bunch and the audience that were just amazing. So I basically hung out in this cottage, and I forgot, and I was just, the lady next door was shoving mashed potatoes and food under by the door. And I didn't wash. I'd lost it. I'd fused.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that a lot of people involved with it had. They'd felt that we'd failed. And we didn't know what part of it failed, because we presented all the artists.
Right.
We'd made all the toilets had worked in the ground. And
650,000 people had been fed for a week. And
yes.
I mean, just to consider the logistical nightmare that yes. you managed to... It was no nightmare. It was a problem that had been solved.
Well, to get them across the island, I mean, we brought in paddle steamers from Scotland. We just, it was like Dunkirk, bigger than Dunkirk.
Uh-huh.
More people than there was at the back. Of the
wow,
town.
Yeah. I mean, that's...
So all of a sudden, it was pouring with rain, and I got a bang on the door, and I'd had this little fire lit, and I'm sitting there just trancing. And I went to the door, and I opened the door, and I suddenly realized it was Richard Cole, who was the tour manager for Led Zeppelin. And I'd worked with Peter Grant, I'd worked with Zeppelin with Dates. And he was a real East End London. He goes, all right, Ricky, enough of this nonsense. Get yourself cleaned up. Come on, I've got a car waiting. We're going to get on a ferry and we're going out to London. I said, no. Leave me alone, leave me alone. He said, no, don't, none of this chicken out. Stop this bullshit. You're getting in the car. Go and get, bathe yourself. Get in the car, get you cleaned up. Peter wants to see you tomorrow. And I said, tomorrow? I'm on the island. He said, we're leaving on the late night ferry. So anyway, I got on the ferry. We drove up to London.
I guess that's an intervention.
Right. It's exactly what it was. It was an intervention. So next day, I went to see Peter Grant, Zeppelin's manager, and Mickey Mouse, who they were partners. And he goes, all right, you know, Peter was just wonderful. He says, all right, Ricky, enough of your feeling sorry for yourself. The boys want to meet you. We're playing Ipswich in 3 days. I want you to go. I've got a car for you. Come down to Ipswich and meet with the boys. So I went down to Ipswich Town Hall. And they were playing down there. And we was in the dressing room. And Percy Plant, Robert Plant, we called Percy.
Mm-hmm.
They said, you know, he said, come on, Rick. We want to do something special. What have you got in mind? And I said, well, I don't know. Let me think. Come on, come up with an idea. And I'm just staring in his face, and I said, what about a circus? Yes. I was thinking of Donovan's Caravan.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, what about a circus? Yes. I said, what about Electric Magic? Perfect. All right, Rick, put it on. We'll do it at Wembley. And Peter said to me, genius. It was not genius. It was just, I pulled it out of my butt. Voila. I just, in the spur of the moment. And that's how we put on Electric Magic. And that was the first arena show that Zeppelin had played in the United Kingdom.
Wow, yeah.
And we had jugglers, and we had plate spinners, and trampolines, and we had sword swallowers, and we had Bronco, and we had Maggie Bell, who just won the NME Award as Best Vocalist. And Zeppelin came on play for 2.5 hours.
Wow, yeah.
And, I mean, in Moby Dick, on the first night, Bonzo played a 30-minute drum solo.
Oh, God.
And a 10-minute drum solo can be boring.
Uh-huh.
After 30 minutes, you still wanted more.
Wow.
And that's why he was playing military seeds. Military seed drumsticks.
Mm-hmm.
Those are military sticks.
Uh-huh.
They're like
trees.
Trees. And
branches.
He was going, I mean, I don't know how the cymbals didn't turn back to wire. I mean, and I just said, you know, Peter was there with a big plate of ham sandwiches. What do you think, Rick? I said, Peter, you have in your hands the biggest rock band of all time.
Yeah.
He said, you think so?
You think so?
He said, well, come down to Saturday. It's my birthday party to Hearst Monsou. We'll have a dinner party, and we're going to celebrate you putting on Electric Magic. How do you like that? And I said, I'll be there.
Excellent. And was that, I mean, I'm guessing that after the Isle of Wight, and then you come back to life, as it were, and you come back to participation in the music scene, one of the truly essential things that you have is the ability to create and produce these events. Now, this leads me into a question about Electrotech.
Well, you know something, this is so funny you should say this, because there's an absolute link. Because Zeppelin brought over a Bob Heil system from America for Wembley for their tour.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, this sound is really good. So I thought, there's a need in UK because there's so many bands. And there were, Jimmy Cliff was just having hits, and Peter Tosh, and then, you know, and then Chris Blackwell called me. And he had Island Records and he had Basing Street Studios. And he called me and said, Ricky, what can we do about sound? And I said, we got to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, I'll come in with you and put some money in if we want to get some. And so I came over to America and I met, in London, I met Sidney Harmon, who just bought JBL.
Uh-huh.
And that's why Harmon Kardon.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And he said, I'll help you. He said, because yes, the need. So I met some really interesting people who were working with the Pink Floyds. And the Floyd were trying to build their own sound system. And there was a guy called Bill Kelsey. And, you know, there was some really interesting, and Cosmic Tony. Uh-huh. And they all had these great ideas. So we all got together, and I put together a company called Electrosound, which I couldn't use in America because it was an existing one, which that's why it became Electrotech.
Mm-hmm.
And I started building sound systems. And Chris Blackwell invited me over to Jamaica, and I went over to Jamaica. And that's when I met with Bob.
Mm-hmm.
And I went down to Trenchtown, and we met, and I could feel everybody's looking at this guy, a very blonde guy. What the hell is he doing here? And, you know, Bob would always say, this is Ricky Fire. He's the bass man. He has the true bass man. He bring plenty bass to the music. And I thought, my God, I better make this bass good. So I got in touch with RCA, who had the RCA W bins, which was what was behind all the big cinema houses.
Mm-hmm.
So I put the 2220 JBLs into that, and I was pumping Crown amplifiers, the Crown 600s into mm-hmm. those. And boy, did we have some bass, and we'd stack them up four high.
Uh-huh.
You know, I remember we did one show and outdoors, and the farmer couldn't milk the cows 3 miles away because the
bass was
the bass was
making the stool fall over.
And you know, and
wow.
We started building these PA systems, and then the groups were saying, well, let's go to America. So I started building them in America, and Chris Pratt said, well, open up in America. And my father, because who he was, knew Crosby and Sinatra and Bob Hope and all those people. And he said, go over and meet Bob and Dorothy Hope. And I came over and I met Bob Hope. And he said, well, I have a warehouse down in DeLong Prairie in Hollywood. He said, I'm not using it anymore. It's a big old place. And he said, I store my props there. He said, take it over and make it your sound place.
Wow.
So it was right behind Cinerama. And that's
round. Uh-huh.
And that's when I met Reggie Wiggins, and he said, didn't you have Stevie in England years ago? I said, yes. He said, well, I'm Maggie, and he had all of those beautiful records. So Stevie came on over and rehearsed there, and it just sort of grew. It sort of, oh, didn't you do this, and weren't you that? And all of a sudden, music was becoming international. It wasn't just British rock and American music.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. This, we're talking about 74-ish,
yes,
74,
yes,
75.
Absolutely right. Uh-huh. And, you know, 68 was the metamorphosis. This was when some great music was being made, and everybody was starting to sort of, the chrysalis of was turning into the butterfly of
yes.
music.
Yes, uh-huh.
And, you know, and we were just... Anybody who wanted to hear bass, mid, treble, and voice, and hear the music as truly as it was being played, we became the de facto company. And there were three of us. There was Clare Brothers, there was Shoko, and there was Electrotech.
Mm-hmm.
And we were basically doing about 80% of the world's artists touring.
Wow.
And, you know, from Ozzy Osbourne to Barbara Streisand to Neil Diamond to, I even went to China with Wham. And the only thing I will own up to is, of all the artists I worked with, I will own up to doing the sound. It was my sound at the Forum when Milli Vanilli got busted. when Phil Price put the wrong CD in and they were singing the wrong song. So anyway, but please don't hold that against me.
Oh, never. It wasn't you. It was your sound.
I was young and I needed the money.
Well, that's really amazing. It seems to me that because I know that many people had tried to solve that riddle. How do you make really good bass? How do you make really good mids? How do the drums sound distinct? And I know that in the being from the Bay Area and being a fan of the Grateful Dead for my entire life, mm-hmm. I know that they built that wall of sound thing.
They did.
Which was supposed to be amazing, but I guess it was really hard to move. And you had three crews, one of them are setting up the rack in the front, and then one's pulling the speakers out of the one and moving it on to the next, and then they're leapfrogging, and no monitors on the stage. They were monitoring from behind them, and they had this special microphone so that you didn't hatch that and loop it. And
well, you know something, King, you're absolutely right. And that system, they spent so much of their money on it, and it was such... It, the Dead, you know, wanted to always create the new de facto Dead idea.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that they hadn't been invented at that time was noise cancellation or phase cancellation.
Mm-hmm.
And I took the benefit of that when I was doing Metallica and Guns N' Roses
mm-hmm.
in the stadiums, because Axl always would run in front of the PA. Well, you know, the minute you put a microphone in front of the PA, you're going to get feedback and squeal for days unless you have really good phase cancellation. The Dead didn't have that. It wasn't, you know.
It was in its nascent form. They had those microphones with the one on top and the one underneath.
That's right.
And it was, they were working on it, but didn't quite.
So you, at the minute certain frequencies would hit those microphones, you would start squealing. So they had to take that out. So the true value of the PA never came across.
Right.
Because given that it was split in half and was left from right,
uh-huh.
or up in the air above them, not with the microphones in front of them, they would have had something pretty extraordinary. But that's the Dead, you know.
Well, and they were experimenting, and mm-hmm. I know that the desire to have that high-quality sound and the effort to create it led to the modern... to what you guys ultimately achieved.
Mm-hmm.
You it seems like you achieved what they were shooting for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's an amazing thing. And I've seen the Panarray speakers that the, I've mm-hmm. been watching rock concerts from, you know, 1966 right. or so. And it's just gotten so much better over the course of time that, you know, it's crisp and it's real and you're hearing it. And so I just, as a fan, as a music lover and a listener and a participant, thank you.
Well, you know, thank me by all means, but let me say that, you know, I get a lot of credit and I get my name and they say the legendary this and all that. The truth is, I could sit here for the next 20 minutes and reel off names. A lot of them are no longer alive,
uh-huh.
but really, really cool, bright people who bootstrap themselves up to thinking of ways to make the experience for the paying, listening audience greater.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can have a great band ruined by bad sound, and you can have a mediocre band made sound great with a great sound engineer and a great system.
That's absolutely true.
I have seen so many times, and if you want to talk about great sound and leaving everything open to the quality of the band, go to a Pink Floyd concert.
Wow, yeah.
You know, the Floyd and I, we started very, very early when they were fired by Brian Morrison Agency. And, you know, and the band was breaking up. And I said, don't break up. Go and have a bacon sandwich at the Black and White Cafe. I'll be there in a few minutes. And, you know, this is when Sid Barrett and all the guys, and they would just said, we're fired. We've got and Steve O'Rourke was actually assistant booking agent, and Tony Howard was the other booking agent. They got fired the same day, and I went around to the Black and White Cafe and said, "Guys, come on! I'll give you 10 dates. Hold it together. Let's see what we can do." And I remember Sid was in tears. He said, "Oh man, well, you know," because they had their own lighting and they were doing their own thing, like you were talking about mm-hmm. Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
They were doing their own thing, and it was too much to come up into these old naffy ballrooms, uh-huh. up the back stairs and everything. And you couldn't do it in the Marquee Club. The ceiling was too low.
Mm-hmm.
So Brian fired them, and that would have been the end. But we went and had a bacon sandwich and a cup of tea, and I put together 10 dates. And I said, I'll tell you what, we'll put 10 dates. I'll talk to Stringfellows in the Midlands, and we'll talk to the Greens Playhouse in the North. And let's see if we can't keep you cycling around. And then when Ian Knight's going to open up the Roundhouse, you can do a Sunday residency there and then Perfume Garden. And they kept together. And that's, I had an old warehouse, and you can Google this down. I had an old warehouse in Marshalsea Road, which was an old grain warehouse where I used to store my stuff. And the Floyd used to live on the top floor. And that's where they wrote so many of their songs.
Wow, yeah.
And this is how we kept the Floyd together, and they went out. And I must tell you something that we talk of great guitarists like Jeff Beck, who I worked with for many years. Don't underestimate Dave Gilmour.
Oh, no, no, no.
Absolutely symphonic guitar.
And there's so many, I'm just going to interject because it's been a heart thing for me. I am a guitarist as well. And I've always, I mean, when I was a kid back in, 16, 17, 18, 19, I could play like lightning. But I can't, and at the time, I was young enough to think that that was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
But over the course of time, as my fingers have slowed down and my appreciation of what music is really all about, I've come to understand that it's the note you play, not how many notes you play. And the choice of notes that David Gilmour has brought to us is epic, absolutely epic. And he's not alone. I mean, Jeff Beck can do it both. He's got the most facile hands, but his choice of how he puts those myriad notes together is what makes his sound, and makes the brilliance of Jeff Beck the brilliance of Jeff Beck.
Yes.
So thank you for pointing out David Gilmour and giving me the opportunity to talk. It's just a little bugbear that's been in my ear forever.
Well, you thank God for slinky strings, because that does mean you can bend a string. Yeah, exactly. You can bend it. You can bend that string without breaking it. But, how music and guitars... I'm going to share a story with you that I haven't shared before.
Wow, thank you.
I worked for many years with Jeff Beck and Ernest Chapman, who was his lawyer manager.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff and I we had a friendship. He's very introverted. He's very devoutly vegetarian. He's very introverted. He would love it if he could just play from behind his stack and just never actually go in front of an audience. And we were playing for Mama concerts in Germany, and we were playing four giant sort of American military bases, but we were playing like the Rajstadion and the Jahrhunderthalle. And we were in the Rajstadion in Frankfurt, and it was the Jeff Beck's group. This is when he had Bobby Tench and Cozy Powell and Max Middleton. And I went out and introduced him, and I just saw this sea of khaki. And I could just smell the bad weed, because that's what it was. It wasn't good weed. And it was just it was the ending. The war in Vietnam was closing down, and they were bringing these young men back, and they were trying to deprogram them in Germany before they brought them back to America, where people were so against them, and it was so horrible. And he went out, and I looked out, and I saw this crowd, and I said, Jeff. He said, he went out and he opened up and he started playing, and nothing. And it was almost, I mean, it's a terrible thing to say, but it was almost zombie-like.
Right.
And I walked out on stage, and I gave Bobby Tench a nod, and Bobby stood back, and I took the microphone. And I said, hey, everybody, can we have heads up? I wanted heads up. Because they'd been used to commands, and everybody's head came up because they were also heads up. I said, hey guys, please open your ears. You have seen things that you should never have seen. You've done things you should never have done. But tonight, I want to find a way for you to wash as much of that out of your mind as you possibly can, because somebody will play for you, will play for your ears, and play for you only. Nothing's going to hurt you. Nothing's going to do anything but make you feel good. Get as stoned as you want. Get as happy as you want. But listen to a maestro who's here to play for you. Please, please, put your hands together for the Jeff Beck Group. couldn't believe it. They all stood up as one. They started clapping and cheering. And it was like a catharsis.
Wow, how and beautiful.
Then all of a sudden, behind me, I could hear... And he took off, and the place went... And he played for an hour and a half. And afterwards, he played the whole show in tears.
Oh, beautiful.
And Bobby Tench, yeah. We're going down. And Max Middle and Cozy Powell was playing like it was his last gig.
Uh-huh.
And you saw these young soldiers, these guys who'd witnessed hell in multiplied by 50.
Yes.
And you saw them getting something back that had been taken away from them.
Again, the healing power of music.
Yes.
Yes, it's so essential.
Yes.
Now, you have another Jeff Beck story that I'm kind of jealous. I wish I'd been there. Because the Yardbirds, we're going back, way back in time. We're just jumping all over in time here at this point. Way back in time, I should take this quick moment to let people know that you're listening to Kwai's Community Radio. We are KKCR Hanalei, KEQAQ Kilauea. And I do have an underwriter that I need to play here. We'll just get it, and then we'll get back to the story. So everybody, listen up.
High Tide Nation presents the Mike Love Band with special guest Sashimon at Anina Ho's Porter Pavilion at 7 p.m. on Saturday, May 25th. Tickets available at eventbrite.com or hightidenation.com. The Mike Love Band with Sashimon, Saturday, May 25th.
And mahalo for your support of Kauai's Community Radio. I'm King Zort. This is the Pauhana Happy Hour, and I'm sitting in the studio with Ricky Farr, a gentleman who... We all should know his name. We all should say thank you to this man for the effort that he has made for all of our mutual experience of music, the betterment of music, the proliferation. It's great to have Ricky Farr here in the studios. We were talking about Jeff Beck, and this is something that you mentioned to me when we met, and that you were there at his audition for the Yardbirds.
Well, I'll tell you. You're absolutely spot on. It wasn't so much an audition. Eric had just announced that he was leaving the Yardbirds to join with John Mayall.
John Mayall, and the seminal Beano album, the first album I ever bought.
Well, you're right there, King.
Dick Hexall Smith and Johnny Allman, and what a great band.
So Georgia Gomelski, who owned Marmalade Records with Apollodore.
Mm-hmm.
And it was run, actually, one of the guys running it was Bob Stigwood, who later on did all the stuff, RSO Records, etc., BGs and so on. Anyway, he was a Russian.
Yeah.
He was Russian. He called me Zariki. Jeff is leaving Yardbirds, Eric is leaving Yardbirds, and I say to him, hell, you go play for peanuts. Yardbirds going to be very big. I said, well, so why are you calling me? He said, come with me tonight. I want to. Jimmy Page, tell me from guitar player, playing 100 Club, and we go late tonight, you and me, and we'd listen. And tell me what you think. So we went down. And there was this three-piece band at the 100 Club, which was really a jazz, late-night jazz club.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm listening to this guy playing Arabic modals on guitar and playing stuff that just you didn't hear anywhere. The closest to it was the blues work of Pete Green in the early Fleetwood.
Uh-huh.
But you just didn't hear this playing. And... they finished, and he came down, and he said, hey, I'm Jeff. And I said, it's Georgia Gomelski. Yeah, I know Georgia, he's the Yardbirds. I said, well, do you want to have a late-night drink, or what do you want to do? And he said, well, I've got to get my bed ready. He was living in an old Pontiac car with the wheels on in the back alley.
Oh, good Lord. Well, Pontiac's a big car.
Right. And that's when he was camping out, And just next door was this, an Arabic restaurant that does the gyros or the gyros, whatever you call it. And I think when you heard the first record that he did, that that guitar, ding, diddling, diddling, diddling.
Oh, yeah, Over Under Sideways Down.
Over Under Sideways Down. That was the sort of music coming from the cafe. And he said, oh, really? Yeah, but, yeah, I'd love that. And Giorgio said, okay, we go to rehearsal room at Marquee, and you'll go to the rehearsal, and you'll be a new Yardbird. And that's how it happened.
That's amazing.
And he, when he left to form the Jeff Beck Group, and Jimmy Page took over, because Jimmy came in the first year as a bass player, and then he mm-hmm. changed the guitar. And then Keith Relf, who was the lead singer of the Yardbirds, had asthma, and they'd just done a opening for, they just, the Yardbirds and Led Zeppelin had done some playing, with early Led Zeppelin, playing in America, and they were flying back on that Pan Am flight. And Jimmy announced, he said, well, Keith's leaving. I've got two guys. I've got Robert and John Paul and a really good drummer, Bonzo. I think it was from the Houses of the Holy, if I remember, a Band of Angels. And Keith was there. Keith Moon uh-huh. was there, right, looning around in first class on Pan Am. And Jimmy looked up and said, yeah, and I'm going to call them the new Yardbirds. And Mooney looked around and said, yeah, that guy down like a Led Zeppelin. And Peter Grant said, that's a good name for the band, Led Zeppelin.
Even better.
that's how the story goes.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, I actually was fortunate enough to see the Yardbirds just after Jimmy Page had taken over from Jeff Beck
right.
in a little high school in Northern California.
Yeah.
And the sound, while okay, was not as great as it would be eventually. So,
well, you know, that's, I know it's overused, but, you know, necessity being the mother of invention, and there's no university for rock and roll, you know, and we used to work so hard, but it wasn't work. We were loving it, and if it was a real job, I'd have been terrible at it. I just wasn't the guy to be employed, but I have to tell you that I just see, it's just, what can you say? You know, you hear something fresh and you hear something new. And Robert Wyatt, when I heard Soft Machine, I couldn't believe that somebody could play the drums like that with a double drum kit. And then all of a sudden everybody was having a double drum kit. And King Crimson. And
oh, yeah.
When I was at Reading Festival and Genesis were just with the original Genesis, with Peter Gabriel. And I went backstage, and there was Peter with this complete black leotard with a surf skin outfit with this complete white face with these massive black eyes. And, you know, this almost like a marionette. And he got a vermette lift like a pyramid. And the start of the show was this vermette cliff with a pyramid rising 10 feet in the air of this black cloth with just this white face and one light on it. And I'm thinking, this is Genesis. This is the genius of Peter Gabriel.
Uh-huh.
And just watching the like you said, the nascence of these bands that become legends, watching their imagination starting to flower. And it just...
Oh, because there was also the at the glam rock and T-Rex, David Bowie, the whole show, which eventually leads to the Tubes.
Yes.
The first time I ever saw the Tubes, they were in a gigantic theater with the stage was massively filled with amazing things. And all of these things came from, or the ability to think maybe we could do this.
Yes. Yes.
Was part of the growth of that era that...
Well, Mark Bolan and T-Rex, I mean, they made that quintessential album. And such, his death was way, way wicked and premature and horrible.
Yeah, and sad.
And terribly sad. But, you know, the Tubes, I don't know if you know this, but I managed the Tubes for many, many years.
Uh-huh.
And that's how
And thank you for that.
Yes. And we had some amazing times, you know, because there was no limit to their imagination. And I was able, had the good fortune to take them. I remember, you know, we couldn't sell the tubes in Minneapolis because the city mothers or fathers had said that there were bare breasts. Well, in fact, they weren't, because we were putting electrical tape over the nipples. Uh-huh. And we hadn't sold any tickets, so I had this idea. And I talked to the band. I said, look, why don't we get the people putting the posters up? And I drew up this rough poster, and Perry Prince was a great artist.
Brilliant,
with Michael Cotton.
Michael Cotton,
and yeah. I said, look, what about putting up some posters? No titties in the Twin Cities. And we put these posters featuring the tubes. So we put up all these posters. It sold out in 2 days. We had it 2 concerts.
Wonderful.
You know, sometimes things play into your hands.
It's amazing if you're flexible enough to not be put off by it.
Yeah, and I remember going back to Minneapolis when I worked with Prince later, and that was a great highlight of my life. What a great artist he was.
Yeah, Prince was another one of those guitarists, like you mentioned earlier,
yeah.
who... It seems like he's not playing the notes. It seems like the notes are playing him.
That's exactly
it's like
right.
It's like there's something that comes through you. I don't know if it's from the floor up or from back to front, but there's something that just the music inhabits you, and then you're a vessel.
Yes. You're actually right. But the thing with Prince is that there are so many things going on around him. It's like looking at a sort of like a minestrone. Or it's like looking at a bazaar of fruit. There's so many different fruits to look at and so many things tastes to have that when you're looking at Prince's dance moves, his voice, his eyes, his whole theater, that almost, you know, you have to really focus on the guitar to realize what great stuff he's putting down.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I've seen him play, and not just in the movie, but in video and that I've seen. Incredible. Just, I mean, phenomenal. The choices that he was making that were almost not like choices at all. It's just what had to be played to fit the song.
Yes.
He's a servant of the song.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, just incredible. There's only a handful of guitarists who can manage that.
Well, you know, it's so hard for these artists when you see... When he came, when he first started, you know, with Purple Rain and when Doves Cry, before him had been so a tsunami of music from so many different genres, and so many things had happened, and everything had been done. Like I say, Pet Sounds, Sergeant Pepper, just amazing, you know, Weather Report, Heavy Weather. So many things had been done. Jaco Pastorius doing things on a 6-string fretless bass that had never been done before. Things had happened. So when Prince would come along and have to and be that original,
yeah,
and find something as original, then it was just... I go back to Marley. Marley found within the reggae rhythms, he found a niche that can only be his own.
Mm-hmm.
And you
Absolutely.
Can listen. I've worked with Burning Spear. I worked with Aswad, Black Uhuru. I worked with Jimmy Cliff. I worked with so many wonderful island music players, so many. But Bob had a way to separate himself and that you know immediately who it is. And it's like immediately you know that it's Led Zeppelin or it's Elton John or it's, you know, Marvin Gaye or it's Stevie Wonder. Immediately you know that who it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that originality and to maintain that originality takes incredible talent and creativity. And I will tell you, working with these artists and being in the dressing rooms and being in the studio, it does in many cases produce... incredible insecurities because this artist is constantly researching themselves,
mm-hmm, yeah.
constantly.
Yes.
How yeah, do I do better than I've just done?
And having to say no. Picasso said something like, "Art is 97% destruction," and so to come up with so many things that you just summarily dismiss.
Yes.
To just keep the ones that are essential and what this truly is really all about. Is, you know, it is. I understand that. I've known artists who just, it's a constant, It's constant struggle and it's constant rejudging yourself. And is it, what do I keep? What do I throw away? What do I keep?
Yes.
Yeah, so
yes, you
I
know,
have such admiration, and I understand that the aspect of insecurity, when it's all about that. And
well, you know, and we go back, let's go back to the sort of primal part that we talked about earlier in the show. And let me just say, I don't know how we are for time, but
we got about 10 minutes left.
Well, Let me firstly say thank you to you for something that I don't normally do. I talked myself out of it, drive my wife crazy. She said, why don't you go and do that? And I kind of, I don't want to sound like an old guy standing by his memoirs, because I still have a lot to add to music. I still have a lot to do in music, and I owe music a lot, and I'm going to be doing as much as I can. But I really felt that there was some immense security and knowledge in you, and I could come on this show and learn from you, because I really need to learn every day, and I have learned something.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, truly.
But truly this, I have fallen in love with a lot of things in my life, because it's the only way you can keep yourself sane, by being in love. And it's not in love with just a person. I have fallen in love with this island. I've fallen in love with the people and how they've embraced their island and how they protect it without being warlike, and you know,
yes,
that they protect it by keeping the purity of it. And this has been a real joy for me to come and talk to you, and to talk to all of you who may be out there listening. I hope I haven't bored you, but love music, and I can just tell you that this is an opportunity that I don't take up enough, but an opportunity that your good man here, King, has brought the best out of me, whatever that may be. But love and peace and music to all of you, and may you be happy and joyful in it. And if I see any of you wandering about that are listening to the music, I hug you, and God bless.
Thank you so much. I'm going to put some music on, and let me just thank you for a lifetime of being willing to do, like when Beatles ask you, they're not famous yet. You're out there making the soon-to-be world-famous recording artists, the Beatles. That the simple joy, the simple wit, the simple fun of doing that, and then taking up, perhaps it's not necessarily a challenge, but it was the let's play. Let's see what we can do. And then recognizing opportunities and making those opportunities into a reality, which a lot of people think, a lot of people have ideas. Not a lot of people. That's what makes people special and unique, is their willingness, the tenacity. That's the boxer in your blood that allowed you to, or almost maybe forced you to, pursue and create. And we've all been blessed by that. And I'm going to put some Jeff Beck in.
Oh, my goodness.
Because
Well, you know, everything you just said, before we go into Jeff,
okay,
and this is not a shout-out, but everything you said, I met and found at a late stage of my life in my amazing wife, who had shown courage and heroism in herself. And all of those qualities that you talked of earlier, I found in her. And if you people look and say, you're not 76, the reason I'm not looking 76 is because I've found that very special thing in life. And music and her, I feel I could live to be 200. God, no. But I take that back. But I'm blessed, and I'm blessed having met you.
Well, thank you so very much. It was such a pleasure. Like I say at the beginning of the show, a man walks into a bar, and this show is the result of that meeting. And I'm just so thrilled to have had the chance to learn about you. I took the opportunity to do my research to find out the stories. And my God, we've only barely covered a portion of it. We haven't even started to talk about your new love, which is creating, I believe it's Riva Audio.
Yes.
And these are times in which people download music and we download them and play them on our phones and we play them through these crappy-ass little speakers. Sorry, you guys, I know that they're great speakers out there, but your love of music and your love of tone is driven you to create this new product that we'll be keeping our eyes out for, and it's premium audio in a compact unit, and
yes,
beautiful.
All the tones and all the dynamics in an affordable way, and you know, we're far from perfect, but we have just won all sorts of awards because you can play Mahler and you can play the orchestras and you can do all of those things. But I will tell you, this has been wonderful, and thank you to everybody listening, and keep listening to this man, because I will tell you, he is a veritable encyclopedia with the love of this island, and you can't get better than that.
Thank you so much, Ricky. Here's a little Jeff Beck for you guys. Stick around, because I have to look at the book. The book says that coming up next will be the Solid Action Show with Stevie D. So listen up, hang around, and again, Ricky, thank you from the bottom of my heart. You made my show just really special. I just am so deeply touched.
And before you play that track, let's finish on that. A British comedian, John Cleese from Monty Python. Yes. A man walked into a bar. What did he say? Ouch.
Here we go, guys. Okay. Thanks again. Tune in next week. I always end the show by saying, if you go out and party this weekend, great. That's fine. But find a designated driver. Don't drive drunk. If you can't find a designated driver, stay where you are until you can drive. And if you see an emergency vehicle coming up behind you on the road, pull all the way off to the side of the road so that that emergency vehicle can get to where it's going, because they've got precious cargo in there, and someday it might be you. So be kind. Live in a kind world, because it beats the heck out of the other kind of world. Amen. Aloha. See you next week.
Aloha.
I've got it bad.